The U.S. Senate backs a massive $23 billion arms sale to the United Arab Emirates. The European Union unveils no-deal Brexit contingency plans in the midst of a growing possibility there won't be a trade deal with the U.K. An official data indicating more than 45,000 people died of COVID-19 in Spain between March and May, a figure that exceeds the official toll by 18,000. I'm your host, Barry Sanjay. It's good to have you with us. The United States Senate is backing a massive arms deal with the United Arab Emirates, despite the country's involvement in the devastating war on Yemen. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Opponents argue that a move would ignite an arms race in the West Asia region. They also point at the UAE's role in the onslaught in Yemen, which has taken the lives of hundreds of thousands of people since 2015. The $23 billion deal includes the sale of F-35 fighter jets and also Reaper drones. The ongoing investigation into the assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has provided a new twist. A U.S. judge has demanded that intelligence services disclose any evidence on the case to a New York court within 14 days.
It's one of the world's worst-kept secrets, but evidence pointing to the involvement of the Saudi regime into the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has been kept hidden from the public domain based on intelligence service requests. However, for the first time since the assassination of the journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, a US judge has ordered the partial disclosure of any evidence held by the US intelligence agencies to be delivered to a New York court within a fortnight. It's most likely that the judge in question, Paul Engelmeyer, is referring to a list of exhibits linked to the murder, and in particular to a tape recording of the incident in which the sound of Khashoggi and the perpetrators of the crime can be heard. Already, the CIA have concluded that the murder was approved by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, although not actually present at the time of the killing, but was more than likely the one who ordered and oversaw the operation taking place.
What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged and therefore is requiring further investigation, in particular of the Crown Prince, for a variety of reasons. The first one is that the people directly implicated in the murder reported to him. So there is a reporting line here that needs to be further investigated.
With the court taking such a step, it could be the first phase in ousting those truly responsible for the murder, and more importantly, removing a cloak of immunity that Bin Salman, for one, is happy to hide behind, hence finally demanding some notion of accountability.
It's a state killing, and as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable. So far, there has been no move on the part of the international community to treat the execution of Mr. Khashoggi as something that was sponsored, incited, ordered by the state.
What now remains to be seen is whether the likes of the CIA and other agencies in the US will obey the court order, or will they too hide behind the veil of national security interests in order to protect the likes of Bin Salman from finally being brought to justice?
The European Union unveils no-deal Brexit contingency plans amid growing fears that the bloc and Britain might fail to agree on a trade deal by the end of the year. The European Commission President published the proposed measures in a statement on Twitter. It's proposed the continuation of road and air links between the EU and the UK for 6 months in case of a no-deal Brexit. It's also proposed a possibility of reciprocal fishing access to each other's waters for a year or until an agreement is reached. The British Foreign Secretary said that the talks are likely to go beyond Sunday if significant differences are not resolved. Dominic Raab urged the EU to move on both fisheries and a level playing field. A political commentator, Alex de Reuter, says that the whole point of Brexit, according to Boris Johnson, is to allow the UK to make its own laws and have a different bigotry framework.
And the point of Brexit, you know, according to Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab and so on, is to allow the UK to, quote, make its own laws and therefore have a different regulatory framework than the EU if they want. Now, for the EU, of course, that too is anathema because they see it as potentially undermining the single market, the integrity of the single market, if the UK were thereby given an opportunity to undercut the EU should regulations there continue to evolve and increase. I'm a bit of a pessimist in this regard. I'm not sure that deadlock can be broken. I mean, the red lines of the two parties haven't shifted, so I don't know what else there is for the negotiators to meet over the next few days and talk about actually is. And unless there's some ground, you know, in the European Council, but the publication of no-deal contingency plans would suggest that the EU are unwilling to compromise any further on those key principles, I would think.
New release data shows the Spanish government highly underreported the number of COVID-19 fatalities between March and May. The National Statistics Institute says the more than 45,000 people died of the disease in that period. That's while the number of deaths released by the government stood at over 27,000 in the same period. The new figure pushes the country's death toll to more than 65,000. The numbers indicated many cases weren't included in the official tally when hospitals and mortuaries were overwhelmed during the first wave of the pandemic. Several human rights groups have warned that poor countries are set to miss out on COVID-19 vaccines amid a rush by richer nations to hoard them.
The People's Vaccine Alliance, of which Oxfam is a member, have looked at all the vaccine contracts that are on the table across the globe. And we've found that unless urgent action is taken by pharmaceutical corporations and rich country governments, 9 out of 10 people in poor countries are not going to receive a vaccine next year and possibly for years to come.
The alliance, which also includes Amnesty International and Global Justice Now, said that rich countries have bought enough COVID-19 vaccine doses for the populations three times over. Campaigners noted that wealthy nations have bought up to 53% of vaccines so far, while they comprise only 14% of the global population. Rights groups urged on governments and pharmaceutical industries to make sure that vaccines are available and accessible to all. On Tuesday, the UK became the first Western country to start distributing the COVID-19 vaccines among its population.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use and have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population 5 times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
China says it will impose sanctions on certain American officials for their approach toward Hong Kong. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hu Chunyang says that Beijing will slap sanctions on U.S. officials who have, quote, performed badly on Hong Kong-related issues. She added that their immediate family members will also be affected. The Chinese government has also decided to cancel visa exemption treatment for temporary visits to Hong Kong and Macau by U.S. diplomatic passport holders. The spokeswoman also accused Washington of using Hong Kong-related issues to interfere in China's internal affairs. The decision came in response to U.S. sanctions on Chinese officials this week over the enforcement of a new security law in Hong Kong. Iran-based Al-Mustafa International University has condemned the United States for imposing sanctions against it. In a statement, the university said that the move reveals Washington's hegemonic and arrogant nature. It stresses that blacklisting a university is a sign of obscurantism. The statement also accuses Washington of promoting terrorism and extremism in the world, noting that Washington is in no position to carry out such moves against other nations. Recently, the U.S. Treasury Department imposed sanctions on Al-Mustafa International University over alleged ties with the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Iran and Afghanistan officially inaugurated the first railway between the two countries during a ceremony attended virtually by Iranian President Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart, Ashraf Ghani. The 190-kilometer-long Khafirat Railway connects Iran's eastern city of Khaf to Afghanistan's western city of Gorian. That's part of the rail corridor and is expected to help boost trade between the two countries and beyond. Rouhani and Ghani held the inauguration of the railway, expressing hope that it would help boost the relations between the two nations.
We are witnessing this major inauguration under two presidents' orders and through virtual space. I am sure today will go down in history of the two nations as a historic day.
The completion of such an important project, despite the coronavirus pandemic, is clearly indicative of the two nations' will.
The Afghan president also said that the railway will be a key step toward Iran's and Afghanistan's economic development. The construction of the line began in 2007. That's part of a much bigger east-west railway project, which will connect China to Europe via Iran and Afghanistan. Our correspondent, Human Abedi, says that the Iran-Afghanistan railway can have a pivotal role in strengthening ties between the two countries.
Well, this project is a very huge project because it is part of Iran's efforts to expand its rail network. Within the past years, Iran has expanded its rail network in five projects, and right now this is the sixth one. This project, which links Iran to Afghanistan, it stretches for about, when it is completed, it is about 225 kilometers, but right now three first phases of this project is going to be launched. 78 kilometers of this railway is in Iran's territory, and 62 kilometers of the railway, the remaining part, right now is in Afghanistan. But after its full completion, it will be about 225 kilometers. About the significance of this project, I can tell you, it can have a pivotal role in strengthening the ties between the two nations. Every year this railway can have about 6 million tons of goods transported.
Well, we had this news of the United States Senate backing a massive arms deal with the UAE, and that despite Abu Dhabi's involvement in the devastating war on Yemen. So let's discuss that a little bit and get some insight. James Jatras, former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, is joining me from Washington, D.C. Good to have you with us, sir. Now, yes. you heard about the resolution and the push in the houses of, Senate and Congress. And finally, looks like that this is going to happen, and it's a massive, massive deal. And this is coming despite all the concerns by both Republicans and Democrats. How would you look at it?
Well, I think the short answer is the money talks, that the Emiratis are among the countries that buy an awful lot of influence in the United States, have an awful lot of friends in Washington, no matter what they do in places like Yemen. And in fact, purchase of all these weapons is one of the ways they buy influence, that when they spend this money to all these companies in the arms industry, these companies all have big lobbies on Capitol Hill, and they want that money coming through, and their congressional friends want it coming through as well. So, people express concerns, oh, look at Yemen, oh, look, this is so sad. But when the rubber hits the road, where's the cash? And that's, I think, that goes through the minds of the people on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. And what do you expect the new administration that's taking the helm of affairs at the Oval Office soon to do with these arms sales to Saudi Arabia and UAE and the like of them?
More of the same. Let the good times roll. That it's a racket for both parties. Everybody knows it. And the Trump administration, remember Donald Trump came in with the idea of America first, but that didn't really happen, didn't it? And the Middle East was all, the Israelis, the Saudis, the Emiratis are traditional friends, and of course Iran is our great enemy. And I don't expect that to change under the Biden administration, that people he's appointing to his administration, assuming there is a Biden administration, are all part of the same apparatus of power. They represent all the same companies. You look at the new SecDef that he named General Austin from Raytheon. I don't expect anything to change. In fact, it may even get worse.
Mm-hmm. And would this bring security to West Asia region that's already a volatile region?
Of course not. It's not designed to do that. It's designed, obviously, there's the profit motivation, and there's also the idea that the United States interests, so-called, are synonymous with those of our various either clients or patrons in the region, depending on how you look at them. And again, in that region, we're talking about Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Emirates, and to a little lesser extent, some other countries in the region, kind of an on-off relationship with Qatar, and again, Iran being the big enemy. So I think we're looking at a pretty much a constant in American policy here.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. James Jatras, former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, who joined me from Washington, D.C. Now, moving on, two U.S. military vehicles have come under attack in the southern Iraqi province of Muthanna. The convoy was poorly targeted by a booby-trap bomb on an international route crossing the city of Samawa. The attack did not leave any casualties. It caused some material damage, though. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in Iraq in the past months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments. Now that follows the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Soleimani and senior commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units in January. Now following that, the Iraqi parliament voted for the expulsion of U.S. troops from the country. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
A report by Brown University Watson Institute's Cost of War Project, one of the premier authorities on civilian casualties in the 19-year so-called War on Terror, found a 330% increase in the number of Afghan civilians killed by U.S.-led airstrikes from 2016, the final year of the Obama administration, to 2019. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading Report Blames Trump Administration for 330% Rise in Afghan Civilian Casualties. Here's the details. The Trump administration's 2017 decision to loosen military rules of engagement meant to protect civilians was followed by a sharp increase in civilian deaths, a report released on Monday, December 7th, revealed. The report by Nita C. Crawford of the Brown University Watson Institute's Cost of War Project, one of the premier authorities on civilian casualties in the 19-year so-called War on Terror, found a 330% increase in the number of Afghan civilians killed by the U.S.-led airstrikes from 2016, the final year of the Obama administration, to 2019. From 2007 to 2016, U.S.-led forces killed an average of 582 civilians each year, the report found. From 2017 through 2019, those same forces killed an average of 1,134 civilians each year, a nearly 95% increase. The sharp uptick in civilian deaths followed a decision by President Donald Trump, in consultation with former Defense Secretary James Mattis and other military and civilian officials, to relax rules of engagement in the Afghan war in order to give U.S. commanders more battlefield flexibility and to gain leverage at the bargaining table with the Taliban as both sides sought to end the devastating war whose course has spanned nearly the entire 21st century. From 2017 through 2019, civilian deaths due to U.S. and allied forces airstrikes in Afghanistan dramatically increased, the report states. In 2019, airstrikes killed 700 civilians, more civilians than in any other year since the beginning of the war in 2001 and 2002. After the U.S. and Taliban reached a peace agreement in late February 2020, U.S. and other international airstrikes declined, and so did the harm to civilians caused by those strikes. According to the United Nations, U.S.-led air strikes killed more civilians than did Taliban militant attacks during the first half of 2019. The report also underscores the fact that a reduction or even total withdrawal of U.S. ground combat troops does not mean an end to war or civilian casualties, as most American combat is one-sided and takes place in the air. Crawford cites U.S. General Lance R. Bunch, who said in June 2018 that the entire purpose behind air campaign is to pressure the Taliban into reconciliation and to help them realize that peace talks are their best option, a policy that has drawn comparisons to the Nixon administration's so-called Christmas bombing campaign against Hanoi or other North Vietnamese cities in December 1972 during the closing weeks of the Paris peace talks. Consequently, the report states that there were more weapons dropped from the air in 2019 and 2018 than at the height of U.S. presence in Afghanistan in 2011. Although there are still 43 days left in his presidency, it is possible that Trump will leave office being able to boast that he was the first president since Jimmy Carter to not start a new war. However, during his administration, civilian casualties have increased in nearly all of at least seven countries under the U.S. attack in the war on terror. Much of the increase has been attributed to Trump's loosening of rules of engagement. While campaigning for president, Trump suggested using nuclear weapons in Afghanistan might result in a quick U.S. victory, while considering the possibility that tens of millions of people would be killed. According to the Cost of War project, more than 43,000 Afghan civilians have been killed during the 18-year U.S.-led so-called War on Terror. Taliban militants have killed the most non-combatants, but thousands of men, women, and children have also been killed by the United States and its allied forces during bombs and airstrikes and bullets. In the wider war against terrorism, estimates of civilian death caused by U.S.-led forces range from around 1 million to as many as 2 million. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kit Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
there should be any concern of us making this documentary.
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people you should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
We're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
They're one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. Everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns that we have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so. And everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is through humour and... sparing shock tactics get the message across too.
He's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Like you said about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous pit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already and the, you know, activists against fossil fuels and things like this as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on as we show the clips in regard to that part of the programme. So Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films even less so because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but it does break it down in quite very obvious terms, uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
We'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases. 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforest for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's freshwater, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on, but I mean, when he talks, he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. Mm-hmm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely, and if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction, it's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant, because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Marie, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and in humane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing. And it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not the term vegan is another matter. Mm-hmm. But they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
I couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing, too, is they say, you know, you use less coal, ride your bike, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it, and it's a political loser. In terms of, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I was invited to a meeting with Al Gore some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushed back. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you talking to all these different organizations. You know, I understand lobbyists. I would expect that from them, and to a certain extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear, that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the VT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another
interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes. Well, exactly. Either they keep their ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost, again, speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been, he would have lost.
He would have lost, yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time, maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Massive
farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing? Actually, they have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think, what is going on behind the scenes?
We'll have to pause you there for now.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is polluting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they were monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learned from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film. because it's such a vitally important subject. You know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatizing it, perhaps?
It's not for me to say. It's hard to say. The fact that the funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists, isn't a surprise as such. But I don't know that. Verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, we hear that according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, yeah. I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the program. I mean, he's been criticized for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.